I think what makes a lot of difference is that people give you a chance, that they see your talents and they like the director of this juvenile institute saw in me and gives you the chance to use and develop your talents.
Hello and welcome to Locked Up Living, podcast which looks at resilience in challenging organizations such as, but not only, prisons and hospitals for mentally ill prisoners and patients. My name is David Jones, and together with Naomi Murphy, I present your Locked Up Living podcast.
Good. So we're really delighted to be hosting a more unusual episode today as part of an exchange with hosts of the podcast Prison Show, Franz Dow and Edwin Kleiss. Although the podcast is most often recorded in Dutch, there are a number of English episodes, so we would encourage you to check it out. At the age of 20, Franz began working with young incarcerated people before heading up the Dutch Psychiatric Pre-Trial Assessment Clinic for 10 years. Between 1988 and 2015, he was director of several houses of detention, prisons for men and women, and director of the Forensic Psychiatric Centre of the Dutch prison system. His last position was as a governor of several penitentiary institutes for long-term, including lifetime, incarcerated people. For the past 15 years, Franz has been involved in international knowledge exchange projects within the scope of incarceration and human rights with Russia, former Soviet countries, Great Britain, the Caribbean, and the USA. This international involvement sometimes occurs due to his own initiative, but he's also worked with the Dutch Ministry of Justice, NGOs like the Global Initiative on Psychiatry and Mainline, and the Council of Europe. In 2011, Toen Valravens and France created the Foundation of Recovery and Return. This foundation brings together victims, perpetrators, families and professionals and supports restorative and transformational justice. The podcast's Prison Show, which Edwin and Franz host, is an activity of the foundation.
And Edwin, you've spent your career since you were 20 in radio and now produce podcasts for a range of institutions. And what's really nice about the Prison Show podcast is you bring the nice curiosity of the layperson to the Prison Show podcast, which probably makes your podcast much more accessible to people who don't have a background in criminal justice. So really delighted to welcome both you and Franz onto the show today.
Thanks for having
it's
us.
It's an honour to be here. Thank you for inviting us.
So, Franz, you've had a very long career working for the criminal justice system in the Netherlands, but a lot of that seems to be in positions where you've been responsible for more vulnerable people. Was that by chance or by design?
Well, I think both. I think both. The decision to work with juveniles was a very simple idea. I'm not very handy, so I can't work with my hands very good. I can carry weight, but I can't repair stuff and things like that, so I couldn't work with my hands. And I didn't have the rest in my ass to work on an office. I couldn't do that either. So I thought, well, I'm going to work with people. That was the choice that I made. And the first advertisement that I saw was in a juvenile institution. And it was the only procedure I did, and they somehow saw something in me. So when I was inside there, very soon I experienced that it was real, that it was my work. And I always have been an idealist and always wanted to change the world. And I always thought that the way authorities operated was not good enough. So when I started working there, I had to prove it myself. And that's where it all began.
And is that kind of, that sense of authorities not perhaps being good enough, is that common to prison governors within the Dutch system?
Well, there's something very funny about that, because I really came from a background of getting kicked out of school. I was locked up two times. I was kicked from school. I was locked up in the police station a few times and stuff like that. So I had a lot of trouble with authorities, which was also a little bit happening in these years. You know, it was time of the big changes in Europe and the 60s, 70s, there was a lot going on in changing the world and stuff like that. But it's true that besides the people who come from university and who work in prisons, there are quite a few people like me. And there was a funny thing. I the 1st of April, my book was published, and I thought, well, I'm very critical and have a very special background, you know, but I experienced that almost all my former colleagues reacted as, you know, we have the same kind of stories in our background. So I think coming from a context of these kind of problems probably is something we have in common. Yeah,
I think that's really interesting. I'd be really fascinated to know whether that was also true of governors in the British prison system, actually. But I mean, people speak, don't they, of how common delinquent antisocial behaviour is for teenage boys especially, and it seems like almost by chance that someone could end up on a pathway.
I think what makes a lot of difference is that people give you a chance, that they see your talents and they to use and develop your talents. And in the stories of all the former incarcerated people who are recovered and who have a social acceptable life right now, that always comes back, you know. Somebody believed in me, somebody said, you can do it. Somebody stayed with me when it went wrong, when I made mistakes. They didn't dump me, they stayed in my presence. And well, it's what I hear all the time, and in my case, it happened very early in my life.
Mm-hmm. Ned Edwin, is that something that was part of your story too? Can you relate to what Frans is talking about?
Well, maybe it's a good thing to tell how Frans and I met. I worked for a regional radio station here in the Amsterdam area. And one day he just walked in with a guy I already met before. But before that day, I didn't know anything about prisons or life in prison, or didn't know anyone who even ever went to prison. So while one of my habits is to always have an open ear, have open ears and open eyes to new things I don't know anything about, I was very curious to know what these people were coming to do. And we talked about it ended up in a pilot for what now is our podcast. I think we can all have similar experiences, whether it is with feeling not let down by people or something. I might have had that with teachers in school who supported me. So that's something I can relate to, but in a different way, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You had your challenges too, like all of us.
Who doesn't, you know? It's like, yeah. We all have our challenges. That's what makes life so valuable, so yeah.
Absolutely. And moving on, in the UK, there was a big inquiry into a high secure service for people with a diagnosis of personality disorder at Ashworth Hospital. And the recommendation from that was for a hybrid service. Can you tell us something about the work of the TBS and how that differs from other work in the criminal justice system?
Yeah. Well, the TBS is has been a very revolutionary system after the war. Yeah, during the war, a lot of politicians and scientists experienced the barbarism of the Nazi regime. And as a sort of consequence of that, they all said, well, we have to humanize our juridical system. And the person of somebody who is suspected of a crime or committed a crime will be central and important in the way we deal with it. So what happened was that in the first place we promoted the idea that prisons are not the best solution. You know, it's not a good idea to put people in prison in general. You know, it's a factor and an action which causes crime and doesn't solve crime. So what happened in the Netherlands was a very liberal movement of politicians, lawyers, but also the head of the prison system, who was a very, who has been there for 10 years when I started, and who has been a very charismatic figure, who promoted, the head of the prison system, who promoted all the time alternative sanctions, you know? So people didn't go to prison, but they got all kinds of different programs and treatments, etc., etc. That was a very important thing. But the other thing was that we realized that people usually don't commit severe crimes because they voluntarily choose to do that, you know? So that's where the we introduced a very new system, and this system was the TBS, and it was very sophisticated because it was, it had five levels of degree of accountability. There were all kind, and actually it was about the question, how free is somebody to choose to do some, was somebody to do something else when he committed the crime? Did he have a free choice to do it or not do it? And there were all kinds of aspects that could diminish the accountability, like being slightly less intelligent than the common human being, or having a psychiatric disorder, or having an addiction, or stuff like that. All kinds of pathology, usually. So we had different levels. We had slightly diminished accountable, diminished accountable, very diminished accountable, and totally unaccountable. So that was a whole range of of different different things. And when you were totally unaccountable, you didn't get a sentence. You couldn't be punished. But you could get a measure like the TBS. And TBS in TBS is invented to for to secure the society. The judge says in general, you can't go back into society unless you are changed. Something is done with the cause of the fact that you started doing the crime. So it's for diminishing the dangerousness, treating the dangerousness, which is a total different thing than giving psychiatric care, for example, to make somebody a little bit more happy in his life or something like that. It's really directed on dangerousness of people. So what we see is that what we saw is that in the time that I was in the clinic, I worked there, we did a lot of said, well, he is we said something about accountability. We said something about the dangerousness, and we said something about the measure we thought that had to be taken. And the measure, for example, could be a whole range of measures. It could also be, well, in this case, because there was a very huge, wide investigation. Also the village and the family and everybody was involved in the assessment. It could be that this guy who touched the local shopkeeper, for example, sexually, that that we said, well, he has to have a conversation with his with somebody once a week, for example, or he really needs occupation during the day or stuff like that. But we also could say he has to go to the maximum secure clinic in the Netherlands and have a very intensive treatment for a long time, for example, because he's very dangerous and we think it will happen again. And so the TBS could last the whole life, but it also can last only a few years. And the average stay in the TBS today is about 10 years. But a lot of things happens in the Netherlands as well. The before, when people were obviously mentally ill doing their crime, they just got TBS. Today we go a little bit more in what you described about the English situation. We first give a long sentence and then the TBS. So retribution is become bigger. And I see, I'll give you one example. There was a guy who killed three people in the tram in Utrecht. It was a very, very horrible crime, you know, very, very bad. He did it all of a sudden, you know. And what I saw in all the press articles and on television, that he was, you know, not accountable at all, you know, not accountable at all. And what happened in the during the court session was that he was screaming at the victims and the family of the people who were died, and the whole country, including politicians, were talking about a monster. You know, he was a monster. And the only thing I saw was an ill human being who didn't behave adequate at all, you know. So I must say that the start of the TBS was very liberal, very human. But a lot happened, because before we had a lot of possibilities also to arrange a leave for people. They could, you know, step by step integrate in society. And every time it went wrong, which didn't occur a lot, because the system, in the figures you can see that our system is very effective, but every time there is an incident, the politicians react by closing it up, you know, and making the TBS more repressive doesn't make our country less dangerous.
Yeah, it's really interesting to hear that. I mean, it was good to hear about, you seem to be talking about restorative justice principles being in operation there, and that's very progressive in terms of something that's only really been taking off more recently within Britain. But it's a shame to hear about the increasing restrictions, which does seem to be more in keeping with the kind of culture that's here and in the US.
Yeah, that's true.
But I wonder, David, is the backdrop to the TBS quite similar to the therapeutic communities then?
Well, it's very similar, isn't it? I remember I visited one of the units that you're describing there, France, when I was working at Millfields, because the TBS system was one of the things that was recommended to all of those projects which had money thrown at them in the 20 years ago or so. It was a very interesting experience, but I don't think we've managed to replicate anything similar in our country at all.
Well, I think it's very, there are a few, when somebody has a mental disorder, you know, there are several stages that you can do something, you know. It starts very simple, the place where he's, that's my opinion, it starts very simple in the place where, the neighborhood where he grows up, you know. It's very important that when there are problems in a family, the family is insecure, or there are other problems, or a child itself has very big problems to deal with the challenges of life, everybody can see it. We see it in the school, we see it in the street. It's and I think it's very important that society, we as a community, me as a person, are more tolerant and more supportive towards people who you can fear that they get into a wrong situation. They are in the wrong situation. You don't have to solve it, but just don't exclude them. You know, that's already a very important issue. And then when they started to do crimes, you know, it's very important to, I think about all the alternatives there are for locking them up, you know. I think one of the reasons that in the Netherlands we have a very small amount of people who are incarcerated, very small, I think the smallest in Europe right now, is that we intervene earlier and that we work with a lot of alternative sanctions. And then it's very important, one important choice, which often has to be made on the police station, is, are we dealing with somebody with a mental health problem who has to go to a mental health institution or getting some other treatment, or are we dealing with a criminal who has to be locked up in prison? So that's also a choice that can avoid locking people up too much, because you choose to organize proper care for somebody. And then during the trial, we talked about it, it's very important to look at the person of the people you think had done the crime, who is suspected, and look at the measure which is effective for him, but also for society. And I think in that range, we have a pretty good system, I think. At least we had it, because it's being broken up step by step right now.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear about that change within Dutch society. I mean, within the UK, the Dutch approach to justice has a reputation for being much more liberal and progressive than within the UK. And Edwin, do you think there's something fundamentally different about Dutch culture and the Dutch national temperament character that allows for more liberal, progressive ideas? Or is there something else in operation within your society?
Well, that's quite a question. The mind state of the Dutch culture, I don't know. I don't know how you look at it from the other side of the North Sea, but how I look at Dutch culture and Dutch temperament is more like everyone is always so very direct and very open. And I always see that as the background of in history. From history, we are, of course, a country which traded a lot, always trading and always negotiating with people. So I think the directness comes from that. But how that compares to our current justice system, I don't know. I haven't studied that, I cannot tell. Maybe France has an idea.
Yeah, I wrote about
this,
and I agree with Edwin, and I wrote about it in my book. one of the things I noticed is that we are negotiating all the time. We stay in the middle. We are not extremely dramatic or aggressive. We are traders. We are not military. We are not, you know. And what happened in the Netherlands is that when criminality increased in the whole Western world, what you saw was that a few things happened in the United States and in England. Very strict laws, new laws, which locked up more people, make it possible to lock up more people. Privatization was very important, and you introduce commercial interest in the whole prison system. It's, I think, very important. And in the Netherlands, our sentences increased as well, but we didn't make such a big step. We didn't privatize. We didn't make very big suppressive laws. We were very fond of our alternative sanctions. So it continued, you know. We didn't build as much prisons as needed. So we were less extreme. We were a little bit more calm. And it's only in the last 10 years that we really have, like in whole Europe, we have a right-wing government, we have politicians who want to be tough on crime and stuff like that. But still we are in amount of prisoners and in amount and in suppression, we are still far behind countries like England, France, Belgium.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's really interesting to hear that reflection on kind of like negotiation and trade, because obviously Britain managed to cover vast areas of the globe, but that was often with the accompaniment of military style interventions as well, wasn't it? I was quite shocked to read recently about the East India Company were allowed to, they were granted militaristic powers in their trading in order to protect trade. So they effectively had their own army and were able to use weapons in order to operate, which it sounds more like the Dutch relied on softer negotiation skills in order to meet their objectives.
Yeah, and we are very small, so we better be nice to the big guys, you know.
Oh, you see it like that, okay? Yeah, we are of course the harbor of Europe, so yeah, all the trading goes through like the Rotterdam harbor and the business centers are there in Amsterdam and The Hague. But before this turns out to be a whole study on Dutch culture, which I cannot tell much about, so I don't know. Yeah.
Okay, Frans, it's interesting that you've had a long career in criminal justice, but have continued to have those contacts since you left. Mm. In what ways has your work changed its direction since you actually left the prison service?
Yeah, thank you for that question. When I was a prison governor, I was loyal to the system, and I did the things as ordered. You know, you can't be so long in the system and not being a part of it and being loyal of it. And when you're responsible for a big organization, 4 to 6 prisons, you also have to demand from your staff to act according to the rules, you know. So I was a real part of the system. But at the same time, I knew very well that one of the most important tasks that you have as as somebody who works for the government, and especially somebody who works in a prison, is to fight the destructive tendencies that come with the system automatically. You know, I came in a prison as somebody who wants to work with human beings. You know, I was always very much directed on a proper relationship and an effective relationship between staff and incarcerated people. And I was less from the physical security, you know. I don't really believe that physical security helps a lot inside the prison. I don't think so. I believe in relational security, which is about respecting the people you're working with, being equal to the people you're working with, really feeling that you're equal, and supporting them and being there, and at the same time have the knowing that you have a different role than somebody who is incarcerated, you know? You have to know your position, because you're the one who turns the key every night. So, in the system, I always was like I was brought up, and like I was as a person, as a character. I was always, they call me a maverick. I was always, you know, close to the edge, and they were always following, what is he doing? But they also gave me a lot of space to do all kinds of pilots and experiments. So I did, I was allowed to do amazing stuff within our system. Well, for example, having a department in my prison where life sentence people could form their own community without staff being there, or incarcerated people designing their own products and selling them to the public, or gardening and giving their products to the, and all, they all cooked and stuff like that, you know, do all kinds of those kind of things. But when I retired, I experienced that the system, although I was a little bit of a, how do you call it, a rascal, the system was also inside me, you know, and I had to get rid of that. And my passion is to make a difference for people and to support people who are in the position that they're not invited to talk, to join at the tables, to be together with us. So in the last few years, I got a position in which of somebody who knows what happens in the system, and who is also, I also have experience in politics and stuff like that, and who is in the first place available for incarcerated people, former incarcerated people, their families, people who are who suffered from violence and stuff like that. And that's I think today I'm retired for 5 years. I'm a very independent personality within the Dutch criminal justice, because all the newspapers and all the people who want an independent advice in the Netherlands, they're not able to find anybody, because everybody is on the pay list of somebody, of especially from the Ministry of Justice. And the people who work in the prisons and the people who are incarcerated, they're not allowed to speak. So that's why my position became so big, because I was one of the persons, one of the only persons who could who had the network inside and outside to know what was happening, and who knew the system.
Such a shame that that happens in forensic systems, isn't it? That it becomes impossible to offer up criticism. Adam Grant writes about something called a disagreeable giver, which is somebody who critiques their institution or organisation, and it's done with the intention of improving the system. But the system's response is often to react against that and see it as being an attack, rather than recognizing that actually we all benefit from constructive feedback.
It's pretty stupid and ineffective, because like David already said, transparency is a very important characteristic of a good functioning organization or community. So when you want to have good prisons, you have to be transparent. You have to let the whole world know what is happening inside there in an honest way. And it's not a public relation issue, which it is now, because the prison system wants to have a good image, you know, in society. When you know how the system works, the image is not important. The right information is important. Also, for the level of violence inside and the level of damage the system does outside.
Yeah, there's such a loss of also all the expertise, you know, because the system's lucky that you've continued to engage with the system post-retirement. But I guess for a lot of people, they'll just retire and that their knowledge and skills and expertise will be lost to the system then.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, it's good that you've continued. But if people were freed up to offer those that criticism in a constructive way whilst they were still employed within the system, you can see that that would bring so much more wealth of experience.
Yeah. More wealth of experience. It would be better for the system. And what I also see is that there's a question of loyalty. You're in or out. Loyalty is very important within systems like prisons. And people who are retired for a long time already still consider themselves of being part of the system. And for me, being a prison governor never was my identity, you know. It was a thing I did. So as soon as I wasn't a prison director anymore, I didn't feel that I had to act like a prison director, you know. So I don't have that responsibility either anymore.
I really like that description of yourself as being loyal, but a maverick.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this whole issue of loyalty is really very interesting and probably the subject of another podcast discussion, I think, because if one thinks about, well, loyalty in the BBC, of course, which is a big issue for us currently at the moment, because that kind of loyalty leads to not speaking about things, out about things that are clearly wrong.
It's misplaced. Yes. It's really is. It's a very important issue. It's misplaced loyalty. I think you have to be loyal to the meaning of what you're doing and the work you're doing, like something like making society more safe. Well, I think I was. I never was. I felt a lot of loyalty to the Minister of Justice, for example. I felt more loyalty for my task and for the meaning of what I did.
Yeah. Thanks very much. I'll move on because I could go down this road for quite a while, but we've run out of time.
Yeah, me too.
Can you tell us something about the international knowledge exchange projects that you've been involved in France?
Yeah. Yeah, when I was director of the Forensic Psychiatric Institution of the Dutch prison system, which was the only one at that time in the Netherlands, I was approached to help with a project in St. Petersburg to found a psychiatric department in the big prison over there with 11,000 prisoners. It was the biggest house of detention of Europe at those days. So what I did, I visited them and started to a project which lasted 7 years. And we sent staff over there and we did trainings and etc. etc. And from one thing came the other. We went to Lithuania to advise the government about a forensic psychiatric system in that country. And we went to Kaliningrad and to Serbia, to Georgia, all kinds of countries. And it was very interesting to work with in different countries and knowledge exchange projects, because it gives you an insight, a broad sight on what you're doing in your own country. You know, it's very inspiring, but also you learn, you really learn a lot, you know. And so I went all over, I still do that. Just before Corona, I was in Belarus and in Texas, February last year. And I'm still learning a lot from how people deal with violence, with crime, the choices you can make as a community, the choices you can make as a country in dealing with that. And actually, when I was in our parliament, in a very crucial meeting where they invited experts to talk about solutions, I used examples from Russia, from Norway, and all different countries to argument that incarcerated people can have more responsibility, more space, more they have more talents than we assume that they have. And that I suggested to create a prison system in which prisons became more self-reliant communities. And I said, well, it's more effective in the resocialization process and more effective when you're looking at money. And then I could start these... So my international experience really helped to argue about, to make my point in the Netherlands.
So did you meet any former governors from Great Britain when you were doing that work?
Well, actually, I've been in Great Britain quite a while. A few times I was in quite a few prisons, for example in the prison where Gordon Ramsay did his Bad Boy Bakery, and inspired on that we started the same kind of initiative in my prison in the Netherlands. And actually it will surprise you, the whole idea of starting a foundation with a former incarcerated guy and the prison director, which was me, to bring all the people together, I was inspired in England. Because you had this organization which was called No Offense, from Sue Clifford, who was the chairman, and Richard Rowley. And they were fantastic people. Until today, they are good friends of mine. And this organization organized events in which all participants in the process of crime, recovery and return, spoke with each other. Not about each other, but with each other. And it was for me a very unique experience. So I visited their events. And then I came back to Holland and I said, well, in Holland, everything is segregated. People decide about each other. They talk about each other, but they never talk with each other. Let's start doing what No Offense does. And that's how the foundation of recovery and return started in the Netherlands. So they also came to the Netherlands to visit my prison, and we had conferences in the Netherlands. So I also learned a lot about from England and from English prisons. And when you started with private prisons, all of a sudden there was also some room for experiments and to try to implement new ideas. So sometimes good things happen over there as well.
Thanks. You've clearly been as busy since you retired as you were before you retired, the many things that you've been doing. Can you tell us a bit more about the Recovery and Return Foundation?
Well, what we do is We get money since a year. We didn't want that because we don't want to be an institute. But they said, well, we give you money and then you can continue doing what you're doing. So that was okay. So we build a new website and stuff like that. But what we do is a few things. We work with a lot of individuals, which call us. And they are in the whole range of former incarcerated people, their families, but also people who are victims of crime and stuff like that. And what we do is not taking over their responsibility, but bringing them together with people who can help them. We support them. We give them a platform in all different ways. I never go for a lecture, for example, without bringing somebody with me, for example. So what we do, we are a sort of point in all kinds of networks where people automatically go to, you know. Like me, of course, I have a long history in the prison system, but Toon has a very long history in juvenile institutions, prisons, criminality, etc. So together we know about everybody and everything in the Netherlands, and so we have a very unique position. And for example, the podcast that Edwin and me make, we never have to look for guests, you know. We just meet them, and if I had to make a program until at the end of the next year, it takes an hour to, you know, to make it. You know, it's just a consequence of the work that we do. And we also work in organizations like Restorative Justice, like organizations that work with juveniles who combine art and artists with working with juveniles and stuff like that. And I'm involved in those kind of things, and I'm always supporting people. And we also advise politics, and we are a lot in the media. So one of the things that that we did in the last year was all the time collecting all the information from the prisons and from the families of incarcerated people and from the staff, the network amongst the staff, and then publish it, make podcasts about it. I wrote a letter for all the families of incarcerated people to the minister. He startled a few weeks ago because the media had made a plan to confront me with the Minister of Justice. So I had a discussion of 1.5 hours with him. What we do is, you know, all the time giving a platform to people to speak themselves out and to emancipate, you know, to let people hear the voices of those who aren't heard right now.
But you can see you must be serving a really important role, given, you know, what you've had to say about how hard it is for people to speak up when they're part of the system. You can see how that being able to speak your truth of the experience must be really important for the Dutch Minister of Justice, to hear those kind of views articulated by someone who's got the experience of the system on their side also.
I think so. But the reaction on my the way I act is very ambivalent. There's a lot of people also within the system say it's very good what you do, but I'm also a threat, because people are talking in my podcast about the situation inside, and when they have a connection with the system. System invites them for talk and says, well, why did you say that? You know? So, they have this, I think, pretty narrow-minded idea that when you have a system with about 16,000 people working there and about 12,000 incarcerated people, that you can look at it as a sort of appendix of your own political responsibility and not allow them to speak out. And the consequences, I know from experience, the consequences are very destructive when you act like that. Consequences within the system, because when you don't give people the right to speak out, the only thing you say to them that they don't matter at all, you know? They don't matter, you know? And when you approach people, also in your institutions, from the start with the idea from you're not okay like you are, and you have to change and you have to be somebody different and don't act like that and stuff like that, then it's about the worst start you can have to start with the rehabilitation process.
Absolutely. It's so interesting to hear you articulate all of that. And I was also interested to hear that about how having guests lined up for a very long, you could easily have guests lined up for a long period of time, because I think for myself and David also, we're very curious about lots of things. So at the moment, we've got guests lined up till probably the end of September and could quite easily keep going ahead, because there are always things that come to light of nice projects that deserve to be platformed in a way where perhaps they haven't been given the visibility that they need because they're not as mainstream within the system. But in terms of the podcast, how did the idea for a podcast come about?
Well, we have a mutual friend. He's called Jemuel, and he's originally from the Antilles in the Caribbean, and he has been in prison a long time ago, and he was an entrepreneur in the hotel, restaurants, pub business. And he did a lot for mentally retarded and handicapped people in his establishments, because he wants to do something back for society, you know, because he also met people who, there we go again, he also met people who wanted to support him, who believed in him. And that's how he got out of trouble, and he wanted to do the same thing for other people. So my son has a company as well, and one of the people who works with my son said, well, the father of my boss, he's working in prison. I don't know what he does, because Jemuel wanted to do something for former incarcerated people because he had been in prison himself. And then he contacted me, and He didn't dare to come to my office, because he thought, well, when I go into prison, I don't know if they're going to release me again, because he had some experience on an airport where he, you know, was locked up because of an old case. But I convinced him to come to my office, and he came, and he said, well, I want to do something for incarcerated people when they left prison. And I said, well, why don't you just come into my prison and start your enterprise inside my prison? I have staff. You can select staff, because there are a lot of incarcerated people here who can work, who have talents, who do all kinds of things, who need training. And I have room as well. I have rooms, places where you can build up your equipment, etc., etc. So he started. And today he works in about 5 prisons. He has roast machines for coffee. He educates baristas. He has bakeries inside. He has building education, building trainings. And he built it up with a lot of people like me, but a lot of other people as well. He built it up a big network of people who can employ them as well. For example, when like building companies, big building consortiums who employ people who come from his trainings inside, and who give those trainings inside as well. But for example, which is very funny, those baristas that he trained inside, they are all over the place in this region, because I live in the region of the biggest prison in the Netherlands. That's where he works as well. And you meet his baristas in all the coffee shops and places around. And for example, I live here with my whole family, so we have a big territory and we have a big party once a year, and then the baristas come here to serve coffee and drinks for everybody. So they do a lot of public relations for the idea that an incarcerated people is somebody like us and a nice person usually as well. He does a lot of promotion for that. So,
another link to our
how
our
we
podcast.
Met. Jamiel asked me to start a radio show on. So we went to Zaan Radio, which is the regional radio over here, and we called it the prison show because I'm always in Texas. I mean the prison show. I'm a host there as well when I'm there, and we started this radio program, and there was Edwin, who was working there, and we made it, the three of us. We made this radio show for half a year. And then I said, I'm going to stop. It takes too much of my time because I was doing a lot of other things as well. And then about 2 years ago, Edwin and Jamiel came to me and said, well, let's make a podcast. That's a lot easier and different. And I must say, I'm addicted to the podcast right now. I love it. I love it. In a few weeks, we have our 100th episode.
Wow.
So...
And
I like
we publish every Friday, so it is once a week we come out with a new episode. A lot of archive material at the moment already. And the first thing Jamiel said about France, I don't know if you're a bit into football, but Johan Cruyff is of course the biggest footballer we ever had in the Netherlands. And Jamiel said, you have to meet Frans. He's the Johan Cruyff of the prison world. So I was very curious at that moment.
That's a huge compliment.
That's a huge compliment.
It got me very curious.
Too huge, and that, I can tell
you. He didn't disappoint me, so yeah.
Is that how he reeled you in, Edwin?
I'm sorry?
Is that how he reeled you in?
Yeah, maybe a bit. But like I said at the beginning of this interview, my eyes and my ears are always open. I'm always very curious. And this was really a world I didn't know anything about. So it triggered my interest. And after that short time on the regional radio, I was like disappointed that it stopped so early and it didn't really... met its form yet. It's we didn't know how which kind of format we had to put it in, and the podcast format is more loose. We just have like an interview, and it might take 20 minutes or maybe more than an hour, and it just depends on the conversation how long it takes, and you don't have to take into account like all the formatting things that the radio usually comes with. So like your interview has to take 55 minutes exactly, and you have to play one song in between of the talks, and etc. So and then we started it up, and now we're building, and more people know about us.
There's something interesting I would like to add to your story, because you made all kinds of programs, a business program for businessmen and all kinds of things, regional stories, etc., etc. And the world of criminal justice, when you involve all the aspects, is a bit like talking about the whole world. We are not very only focused on prisons. So
it's all connected.
Especially the last half year, we did a lot of... programs about neighborhoods, for example, where people work with kids over there, and violence in the most wide meaning of it, and stuff like that. More about society and about how we do things in the community together.
I think that's so important, though. Yeah. So just because forensic systems can seem like a bit of a silo where people only talk to the same people repeatedly, and actually looking outwards into society brings something more valuable in, I think. But Edwin, you were going to add to that.
Oh yeah, well, I was. What was I about to say? That it's all more connected, and our podcast becomes more broader than just crime or the prison system. It's more becoming a society podcast. So I mentioned to Frans a couple of days ago, maybe we have to change the title, but the title is so strong, Prison Show. It really grabs your attention when you hear it for the first time. So let's keep it like that. But we are becoming way broader in our topics. Yeah.
And our mission is also that to show that prisons and forensic patients are not some kind of long distance thing, not mm-hmm. from another planet. It happens in every street, every piece of every street of everybody living here. You know,
yeah, it's so important.
You don't see it, but it's there. It's there. It's everywhere.
So important. And Edwin, could you because you have done a number of episodes in English, haven't you? Could you say something about those so that our listeners might want to check those out?
Well, I can send you a little overview of our episodes in English, but there are some I can mention from the top of my mind at the moment. Franz, you went to Texas 1.5 years ago. And you made a lot of interviews there, and that was very interesting for me. I unfortunately didn't go with him. I stayed here and listened to his interviews, and that was really interesting. And shortly after the Black Lives Matter demonstration last year, we did an interview with Breon Bain, which is very interesting. He's an activist and a poet and a musician, and he does a lot of things, and he's from the US. And there are some more episodes in English, right, Frans?
For example, with this lady in Belarus, Ludmila.
Yeah.
In Belarus, yeah. That was an amazing lady.
I'd encourage people to check them out.
Maybe.
I would encourage people to check them out.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
people
yeah.
that listen to this podcast. I think there's something interesting about hearing yeah. those.
I could perhaps give you some links to those episodes to put in your show notes.
So that'd be great. Thank you.
You can easily find them. Yeah. Yeah.
That's great. Yeah.
That would be good. Okay. You've answered my last question, it seems to me, which was going to be about how the podcast has changed over time and how you keep it fresh. Well, you clearly keep it fresh by having a dynamic approach. And as you put it, France, the prison system and the criminal justice system is about the whole world.
Yeah, it's been brilliant. Thanks so much for being so patient and answering so many questions.
Yeah, it was very nice to talk to you. I really felt a lot of connection with you doing what you're doing. Yeah.
Many thanks again to all of you who have listened to our Locked Up Living podcast. Feel free to mention this to your friends and to your colleagues, and give us feedback on our webpage lockeduplives.com and our Twitter account Locked Up Living. Many thanks too to Pete and Rach, who kindly allowed us to use their music. You Have Called Me Courage, and this is available from all the usual outlets.